All right, here we are. Welcome to another episode of Let There Be Talk. Today is, what is it? I believe it's the November 19th. Welcome to the jungle. The jungle of life, the week before Thanksgiving. The pregame is about to happen. Yeah. Pre-game of the holiday fucking lunacy. You guys ready for that? Go eat with your family members. Maybe you're gonna get the grilling like I do sometimes of like, are you still doing that stand-up thing? It's so weird. Like people get a little booze in them and they're dying to just try to. Let's ask him, what's going on? I mean, like, we don't see no Netflix special. Everybody seems to have a Netflix special. Are you getting a Netflix special? How come you don't have a Netflix special? Maybe you're just not that good. I mean, you know, these other people, they got Netflix specials. Yeah, you know. Anyway, here we are getting ready for a great week. A great week, you know, eat some food, throw down some carbs, dodge the damn sugar for me for the third year. No pumpkin pie. Third year of no fucking pumpkin pie. You know how loony that makes me? Man, I am a pumpkin pie addict. I worship pumpkin pie. Oh my God. I'll eat a whole, I remember one year, Bill Burr made me a pumpkin pie. He was making pumpkin pies, and he made me one, and I ate the whole thing in like an hour or so. I just kept walking by it like, yeah, I'll just get another piece here. And then finally, I just kept the, like a fat fuck, I just kept the pie tray at the table and just polished it off with whipped cream and cinnamon, like an animal. He's a goddamn animal. Anyway, welcome. How are you guys? Feeling good today. Just out here in New York City working nonstop, doing stand-up. I'll be at the Cellar, Comedy Cellar, on Thanksgiving Day. Three shows if you want to come down. Three shows. Rocking some comedy all night down there. So that'll be fun. I want to give some love right now to all the new Patreon donators. People have been loving these bonus episodes on Patreon. And you can jump on board, too, by donating to patreon.com/DeanDelRay. I put out an episode every week of me just shooting the shit. And I hope you guys are liking it, all the Patreoners. Let's give their names a run here. Sean McEwen, Peter Doherty, Jasper Christensen, Ryan Hall, Ryan Spanks, Sam Soupy, Blake Seal, Miguel, just one name like Prince, Miguel, Beat Keller, Andrew Encinas, and Mike Bolansky, I believe. Thank you, guys, for donating to the podcast and enjoying these bonus episodes on patreon.com/DeanDelRay. Great guest today. I can't tell you how much I love doing this interview as I listened back to it a couple days ago. I was like, this man is the real deal. It's hard to find somebody out there that's the real deal in the music world. And when they come around, you know, the Marcus Kings, the Rival Sons, all them witches, all these new bands that are out there just fucking slugging it away with definitely about 99% of possibilities of not being able to make a living at it, but not caring and going for it because that's what's in your brain. That's what makes you tick. The sound of rock and roll, doing art, playing music. And I love that, man. I love when people are out there doing it. I'm doing it, and it's crazy, but I feel better than ever. My guest today is Phil Campbell from the Temperance Movement, which is the hardest band name ever to say. but I love this band. Saw them finally after about, I think, 4 years of trying to see them. I caught them live at the Mint in Los Angeles, and it was spiritual. And it was an amazing night of rock and roll. And that band and this singer are just killers. Phil is just fire. And I hope that one day you guys will get a chance to see this band, because it's very hard to see them. They don't tour much in the States. But what you can do is go to iTunes and listen to all three of their records. They are absolute gold. Absolute gold. You're going to love this episode, and I can't thank you guys enough for tuning in. I know that Black Friday is coming up. A lot of stress. People need to buy people stuff for the holidays. That's some kind of thing. Or maybe you just want to buy yourself something. Check out my man, M.W. Reynolds, out there in Denver, Colorado. One of the finest stores I've ever been in. They got all my favorite brands. Schott, Belfast, Filson. They got incredible denim. They got all kinds of great winter wear. Just a smoking store. And now, right now, if you just go to their website, you can get a discount. All Dell Razors. And this is only for a limited time. So do not miss out on this. I'm telling you, man, to get a discount on like a Schott jacket or a Belfast or a great Filson bag or any kind of denim, you're going to get 20% off. MWReynolds.com. This is for a short period of time only. And I'm telling you, they've got the greatest stuff in there. Do not sleep on this. I know you guys love the same stuff I do. You listen to the handmade episodes. MWReynolds.com. Use the code DELRAY and get yourself some great deals for the holidays there. It's for a limited time only. So do not sleep on this deal, mwreynolds.com. And if you are in Denver, go in the store. It is an incredible store. They got all kinds of great vintage motorcycles. And I love this place. It's one of my favorite stores in America. Check it out. Use the code DELRAZOR for 20% off. Also, how's your hair looking? You got to have good hair out there, right? You got to be the Fonzie. You got to be the Fonzie at your office. Go to hairclub.com/Delray today for a free hair analysis and a free take-home hair kit, all valued at over $300. That's hairclub.com/Delray for a free hair analysis and free hair kit. Experience your hair and your life at its best only with Hair Club. I'm certain you're going to love Hair Club. Check it out. You want to get your confidence up, Hair Club's going to help you. They're re-inviting you to become part of the Hair Club family. Check it out. They understand emotions you're feeling, and now you can ask all your questions at Hair Club. They'll customize a program for you. Go to hairclub.com/Delray today for a free hair analysis and a free take-home hair kit. Come on, Delrazers. Get your rock and roll hair together. That's hairclub.com/Delray for a free hair analysis and free hair kit. Experience your hair and your life at its best. Couple good offers for you guys out there. Couple good offers. Take advantage of them. Helps the podcast and it helps your pocket. You know what I mean? Nothing better than getting a little sweet deal. Let's get into the episode here. Oh, one last thing. I got the new Delrazor shirt. Email me, deandelray@yahoo.com for how to buy it. The shirt design is in my Twitter and my Instagram. It's the new version of the Grateful Dean shirt. And I love this shirt. I love it, man. Grateful Dean. Perfect for me. I'm grateful to be doing stand-up at 52 years old. So it's a great double entendre. Is that a double entendre? All right, I love you guys. Let's get into the episode with my man Phil Campbell here from the Temperance Movement. Have a great Thanksgiving. All right, here we are, another episode. Great guest today. Well, introduce yourself.
Hey, man, I'm Phil Campbell from the Temperance Movement.
How are you, buddy?
Yeah, I'm all right this morning. Yeah.
Great. Yeah, this is, I haven't done a 9 a.m. interview, I don't think, ever. Maybe once. Once in a while, you get a guy in a band who's maybe sober now.
Yeah.
And his demons wake him up at like 7 and he goes running and stuff. Yeah, one of those guys like, I can do it at 8. Yeah. And they go, at night? They go, no, in the morning. Like, who's up? I had to get you guys because you're about to hit the road. You played a gig last night, which was just incredible, at the Mint. I had not been there in years, and man, it felt good to be there, you know? How great is that place?
Oh, no, that was an amazing venue. We've been out on the road, we've been playing in big venues. We come on and we play half hour before Judas Priest and then Deep Purple.
Yeah.
And along the way, we've put in 3 shows of our own in small clubs, like in the Mercury Lounge in New York. We played up in Toronto at the Horseshoe and the Mint in LA. And those 3 shows have been what we've been living for out here, you know.
Yeah.
Because we get to play, you know, 90 minutes or whatever.
I first found out about your band in 2012. I was, I think somebody sent me this video. It was that Only Friend rehearsal thing.
Yeah.
And it's like, I think it was like 3 songs you got shot kind of, or different song, you know, different videos. But that was the one I saw. And I was like, wow, this band's great. And I go to try to get your record right away on iTunes, and I couldn't get it for like a year. Mm. And I was trying to see you guys, and I was just like, oh, well, maybe this band just doesn't tour over here. They're one of those bands that got a deal in Europe and just is new over there. It's taken me this long to see you guys, 3 albums in.
Yeah. Now, we the Only Friend video was before we were signed, and we just what happened in that was we captured a lot of energy.
Yeah.
And we filmed it and performed it about 10 times and then cut it all together. So every edit and every cut point, we're playing full blast. So I think that's what came across, was this incredible energy. We were unsigned. It was the first thing that we...
You were unsigned on that?
Yeah,
wow.
It was the first thing that we had
Holy
done.
Holy smokes.
We were unsigned. We released an EP.
Yeah, Pride.
On our own, which had 4 tunes on it, or 5 tunes on it. And it took a little while to get up and running and get started. We cut a deal with Earache, and then we started touring. But we were touring in Europe before we got the deal with them. And but it was some time. In fact, it wasn't until early 2015 that we got over to America.
Yeah, yeah.
Because we had to cut a deal here because it's just a European deal that we have.
I remember I'm a comedian, so I was on the road and I was in Denver and you guys were coming the following week in 2015 in Boulder.
Yeah.
And I was like, shit, there's that band, man. You know, how am I going to see him? Now, let's get into the history of the band. I don't know how old you are, but... you know, was it your first band, your third band, or what's going on? How does it get together? And then, because once you get together and you start happening, things start happening pretty quick in Europe, right?
Well, it's strange because, I mean, I've been about for a while. I'm actually 43. I started music when I was 18, 19, got my first deal when I was about 20, 21 years old.
Wow. And was it like a rock band?
Well, I started out with a band in Glasgow. Then I moved to London and started a solo career. Yeah. I cut an album and when I was just a kid and just at the tail end of the 90s when there was still a bit of money around, and it was like a really overpriced demo that I made of all the things that I thought I wanted to do. After that, there was about 13 years of solo things.
Solo records, or did you put one out and get dropped, or were you just putting out?
Yeah,
solo
that record I put out, then I got dropped. Then there was a little bit of nothing happening before I got another shot at it, and tried again, and it still didn't break, make it through. A lot of bad luck, a lot of stopping and starting. I was living in London, so I come from Glasgow, but I moved down to London just at the in 96, and you know, I was going to be, you know, an Elton John or a Neil Young or something like that.
Was it folk, like acoustic?
Yeah, I played acoustic guitar, I played piano, and I, you know, just, you know, put together something like a sort of pop rock, or I didn't really know what I was doing. It wasn't until I was in my 30s that I was really more settled as a person and also as a musician. I moved back to Glasgow in 2009, gave up on London, came back home, felt a little flat.
Yep.
That I had spent so much time away. I was like 33, and I thought, well, that's that. And so it was a case of starting over up in Scotland. I didn't really know what I was going to do. I tried to make some more music and do some gigs, but it was really, really difficult to do that. But one of the people that I had met before I left London was a guy called Luke Potashnik, who I met at a gig in Earl's Court. And I just knew that I wanted to work with this guy, you know, and we didn't know how we were going to do it. And we met up a couple of times and spoke about putting together a band. Do you like the Black Crowes? I love the Black Crowes. Let's make a band that sounds a little bit like the Black Crowes. He says, I love the music that you make, but I like it when you sing like this, and yeah, we can maybe do a bit more of that. Yeah, cool thing. I've got to leave. I've got to go back home. I can't do that right now. All right, okay. So it wasn't until another, like 2010, that I got the call from him, and we started something.
That's interesting, because by then you're in your late 30s.
Yeah.
And were you working a job or anything?
Yeah,
the reason I relate to that was I started comedy at 44.
Right.
I'm 52 now, and I'm getting somewhere. But I never stopped. You know, I played music all my life and then kept going. There's something in you, right? But yeah. Were you working jobs in
yeah,
between
sure.
that?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I was up... I mean, I was actually, you know, living back at home,
mm-hmm.
and working coffee shops and doing anything that I could to survive,
yeah.
And pay bills, and you know, and it was exactly at the point where I kind of thought, I remember one of the last solo things I ever did, I just kind of gave up in the middle of it. You know, I just thought, what's the fucking point of this? You know, let's just grow up. And pretty much stopped. And in the same week is when I got in touch with Luke. And I was at that point where I thought, you know what, I'll do anything to just be happy and be making music that I feel is actually going to, you know, go somewhere. And I like this guy. And he introduced me to Paul. And I thought, these two guys are brilliant. And then we met Damon and we met Nick. And I thought, this is a great bunch of people. You know, this I believe in. Let's go. Let's move. And I was up and down to London. We were writing songs. We were demoing things up. We were starting a band. And I'm singing like I've never sung in my life. And yeah. I'm 35 at this
yeah,
stage.
Yeah.
You know, I've never really been singing like that much.
You mean like a lead singer, Todd? Because there's definitely some Steve Marriott there. You got some maybe Frankie Miller, some Stewart, but it's definitely comes from the put together as the Chris Robinson thing, which I picked up on right away. Like
yeah.
before in your solo stuff, what were you singing? Like it was a more cleaner singing? Or?
I love Tom Waits, and I used to love writing kind of sort of hymnal, heartbreaking songs on a piano.
Piano ballads.
Yeah,
right.
And if I was playing on a guitar, it would, you know, I was singing softly, sort of beautiful, whatever, but I was never really singing rock.
And
I was very much, I was very much kind of in wanting to be in charge of every aspect of the recording, and you know, even to be playing everything, and so it was this massive effort where it, but there was no sort of outlet for it. It wasn't going anywhere, you know. So the temperance movement kind of offered me the chance to kind of chill out a bit, stand back, collaborate, and learn how to sing without a guitar, without a piano. So I'm concentrating on that, and I'm learning, and I'm singing over two guitar players,
yeah,
who love the Black Crowes, and so I'm singing, and I'm thinking, and it's suddenly Chris Robinson, it's, you know, because, you know, the Amorica record came out when I was, you know, just about 18.
Yeah,
it's the best thing I think that I'd ever heard at that point.
It's a masterpiece, and when I hear "Ain't No Telling,"
yeah,
I definitely right away once I get the first record,
yeah,
I'm like, oh, Black Crowes is probably the top five band for me. So immediately I gravitate towards you guys, and I could tell where it was coming from, but it was definitely organic too, and sounded like you got yourselves. But specifically in Ain't No Telling, when it goes into the chorus, it's kind of got a Cursed Diamond vibe.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's what I heard as well. When I heard that, it was sent up to me. It was, you know, they were just jamming the verse and the chorus going up, and I thought, shit, this is great, you know. And that's kind of where that was my end. That was always my favorite song that we would play.
It's so great
because of that. You know?
Yeah, you played it like fourth last night. And I was I always, now that I don't play music anymore, I sit outside of the biz, and I look at it as like an 80s A&R guy. Let's say I always, if that hits me now, you know. And I'll watch a band and I'll be like, this is the song. Yeah. And I can always feel it. It's so weird, magically. Like, you know, when you're outside of a band, when you're in a band, you're like, I know this is the song.
Yeah,
sometimes
that's
the people don't know the right song.
Yeah.
And you go, no, man, this is the song.
Yeah, man. But bands are blind to their own strengths, you know, and what's really what everybody loves that they do. They think it's something else.
Yeah. You know? It's funny when you, I don't know how old you were when Morica came out, but it's interesting to talk to somebody that loves it like yourself and me, because you've got the first Black Crowes record, which is, you know, some faces and some fun, you know. And then during that time, you had like London Choir Boys, and there was kind of that thing going on.
Yeah.
And then you get Southern Harmony, which is a masterpiece.
Yep, it is. But
when you get to Amorica, you know, it's like, oh, wow.
Yeah, that's the shit. That's the sort of real deep end of the Black Crowes.
And they become themselves. And that's how I kind of feel about your new record.
Yeah.
Because when I hear your first record, which I love and I think is fantastic, but you can hear the influences. Mm. But by the time now that we're on your new record, it just sounds like you guys, you know?
Yeah, it's certainly... It certainly came together quite quickly. After a couple of years of trying to write some new material, and you know, we were touring, we had toured these two records, and then we lost a couple of guys in the band.
Yeah, that's always a blow, right?
So Luke left, and it was a real shock, because I thought, well, he's put the thing together. We were going to write all these songs together. What's going to happen? And then, you know, we lost Damon on the drums as well. And I was like, shit, we've lost the drummer. But, you know, it's just touring, you see. And because, you know, so we're saying, yeah, it's nice. You don't need to be young to be doing something great. You know, it's coming a little later in my life. But what happens is, when it's a little later, you got kids, you got a wife.
Totally.
Right?
Totally.
And so being away on the road for the amount of time it takes to break America, whatever that looks like, you need to go there for 3-4 months, and then you come home and then you go back again for another 3 months.
Rival Sun style.
You know, you need to just keep hitting it. But so you're away from home for 3 months and you've got a young daughter, or you've got, you know, you've got three kids. Damon had three kids and wives. And it's not for everybody, you know, because that strain that happens when you're at this, you know, we're in our sixth week of being here, shit that's happening back home, it's just so far away, you can't do anything. My little girl needs her daddy.
Yeah.
You know, but, you know, and I want to be back there. And so that's the difficulty. And for Luke, he just was like, I can't deal with this. You know, I don't want to be away from my home and from my family. And so that was that, you know.
Yeah, people, when they're younger, you got nothing to lose. Sometimes guys can go like 10 years. You know, you don't have kids and roots and stuff. Yeah. And you're ready to burn rubber out. But when you do, like you said, make it start to make it happen as you're older, you're like, and a lot of people, we talk about it on the show over and over, there's no money.
Mm.
And then it gets like a full stress, like, why are we out here for months and we're going home with no money? How am I going to explain that to my family? You know what I mean?
No, this is it. You know, and the whole thing becomes a challenge because, you know, you love the music and you want to be doing it. And you kind of, it's a madness. You just keep going and keep going and trying to make it work. And you know, you know, when I first came to America, I thought, why did I not come here earlier? Why was I not here 10 years ago? But I wasn't. That's just the way it is. And so, you know, and with something that's really amazing, I don't really care what it is, what band it is or what song it is, there's always going to be difficulties around about it. Always. And so we know very clearly what the difficulties are for us. You know, we got back together with Deeper Cut. We got some new guys in. We got Big Matt on the guitar. We got Simon Lee come in on the drums, and we just worked and worked and worked. First of all, at trying to play what we had played, you know, for the first two records, and out of that. Then we started to write a third one. The dynamic had shifted because there's just two different people in the group. And Deeper Cut is basically the sound of us deciding that we're going to keep going. And sort of trying to sort of just bring a little bit of diversity into the band, because as good as the first record was and as good as the second record was, there was elements that we didn't include that we had in our first sit down with coffee discussions before we'd recorded anything. We love the band, we love, you know, Leon Russell, we love Elton John, we love all that kind of stuff, as well as the heavier end of stuff that we talk about, the Black Crowes, All Night. But, you know, I love the band.
Yeah.
You know, and I want to actually sound like that. You know, I want us to chill out, you know.
Yeah. When you guys start doing the band and you start singing, and obviously this new style comes out, is it like, because I watched you sing last night and I kind of sing in a similar style to you. Was it taxing on your vocals, or were you, was it pretty natural? Were you doing a lot of warming up, figuring out this new style, or was that really your actual voice?
It was something that I have had to, it's like a muscle that I've had to develop.
Yeah.
When we first started, the first real heavy touring period we did was we went to Sweden, right, in the summertime, and we went there for about 5 weeks.
Wow.
And I have never felt, you know, more tired, exhausted, physically, my shoulders, my neck, because I, in order to sing like that, it's all coming up. My neck is strained, and you know, it's bringing this voice through the whole time. My shoulders and everything. I have to be fit. And at first, when I was working that out, it was hard. My voice would break down an awful lot. We would be doing 3, 4, 5 gigs sometimes in a row. And then I'd be gasping for a day off. And even after that day off, I'd go back and it'd still be fucked, you know. And I think that and then we came to America and did the same thing. And I just learned that if I just keep singing every night like that, doing an hour show, it goes through different stages. You know, you have the perfect voice for the first few shows. It breaks down. And then after a rest, it comes back again, but it's a little bit different. It's a bit more leathery. And just sort of layers and layers and layers of that until 7 years in, you know, I'm able to do it most of the time, because I've increased my range.
Wow.
I never used to be able to sing as high.
Yeah.
And even like when we write a song like Love and Devotion, the chorus, when I wrote it, I couldn't really sing it. I could sing it one time, you know, and send it down and say, you know, here's what I think we could sing in that chorus. But then trying to sing it, I had to learn how to sing it by singing it over and over and over again. So, you know, you can stretch the voice is adaptable, you know, and that's what I've learned.
It's a muscle.
Yes.
Absolutely. When you guys are tracking the new record and you guys are in there, are you tracking live? The first record obviously is pretty much live, uh-huh. You know? But are you tracking live everything and then just dubbing vocals, or how are you guys recording this?
Well, the first record, there was a great emphasis on trying to get the live performances, even the vocals. You know, the vocals. I think, you know, a lot of it was dubbed, but a lot of it was live, and I would just fix bits. You know, if I had fluffed a line or something, because I was in a little booth, but we were all in the same room, and right. I was just boothed off, and we would do one or two, maybe three takes of each tune, and then we would have it. We did that again for the second one, but there was more overdubbing, and then the third one we just kind of freed ourselves a little bit, so everything was tracked, you know, to get the rhythm section,
and then to
get the vibe. But there was a little bit more attention to what was going on with the guitars.
Now, how's Earache as a label? I know that Rival Sons was with them for years, and Rival Sons, you know, they just toured and toured and toured and toured, and now they're on Atlantic Records. But it seems that Earache seems to be pretty good in a way of, like, maybe you don't sell a shitload of records, but they let you keep making records, which is really strange in this landscape of music business now, you know?
Yeah. Earache were there right at the start. They, you know, when they like everybody else, they had seen the Only Friend video, they had listened to the EP that we made, and made it clear that they were interested in us. Our contact here is a guy called Dan Tobin. And we liked him. We really liked him. We were just like, what else is out there? You know, what can we get? We were trying to get, you know, just try to look at the landscape and try and see what kind of deals were out there. We went with them because we believed in him, right? And you know, they were a heavy label, you know, with Napalm Death,
of course,
famously.
Yeah,
and
yeah, exactly.
And it was kind of not what we were doing. But this guy was like, look, we've just signed Rival Sons. I'm trying to, you know, sort of change it and, you know, sort of adapt the label to include blues rock. You guys would fit in. And exactly what you said is, you know, we're just about to go and make our fourth record with Earache. And, you know, who knows? We might not even have got a second record if we had gone with X.
Not at all.
You know.
Not at all, man. It'd be like,
major
okay,
label,
see you later.
You know, because of the sales, yeah. You see. So with Earache, you know, they've just sort of believed in the group, given us freedom, don't interfere with what we do, and let us record music, you know. In a climate that has completely changed for bands, where, you know, you've got to really work hard out there on the road to basically sell your records at the side of the stage.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
You know, you may get lucky, you know, the landscape might change, I don't know, but it's, you know, for us, as we're a working band, we're out there, we believe in what we're doing. You know, they've allowed us to do that. They've allowed us to be that.
That's great, man. Your live show is incredible. I mean, I watched you last night. One thing I did notice about your band, and I wanted to ask you about this, if it was intentional or what, but it seemed early on that your band definitely had a look. You know, you guys had this look of kind of a hipstery, yeah, rock and roll band, and now it kind of seems like it's just like we're each ourselves now up here.
I think so. I think when... I think that was the first beard that I grew was when I met those guys, and so you had Damon with a beard, and Luke had a beard, and, you know, Paul started growing a beard. And, you know, I'm like, I'm not going to grow one. I'm going to, yeah, I grew one.
Yeah.
And, you know, I got myself a little hat and stuff, and, you know, and just, I loved that. I loved that whole vibe.
Yeah.
You know, and it was, that was how we started out. And I think that we just, you know, your clothes just get dirty after a while, you know, and you just want to get some new things. I just kind of try and keep it connected somehow with a little kind of British mod. Personally, yeah. You know, I've kind of settled on a kind of, you know, Steve Marriott, kind of Rod Stewart, kind of look myself, but we don't ever, you know, coordinate really what we look like. Everybody just wears what they want.
Yeah. It was interesting because when you guys walked on stage, I was like, I don't even think this is the band. It was so funny because you looked way different because I'd never seen you live. It was almost like when you meet someone online for a date and they show up and it's been 5-6 years since those videos that I watched. So then, you know, you're like, oh, this guy sent me an old photo. It was funny. But then as soon as you kicked into the first song, I go, oh, this is definitely them. You know what I mean? It was wild. You guys, you got pretty lucky early on. You got some great gigs. You opened for the Stones.
Well, you know, it's interesting. The Stones came as a massive, massive, massive surprise. But we have always had great luck. I think one of our first shows after
the Royal Albert Hall
with Deep Purple, you know, with the Sunflower Jam for John Lord's cancer charity, and so that was we had played like maybe 3 small gigs in clubs, and then we played the Albert Hall and we opened with 2 of our tracks. Ain't No Tellin' was one of them, and here was Alice Cooper and here's Brian May and here's Jeremy Irons and they're all having dinner and they're all looking at us, and suddenly we've got Deep Purple, you know, and that was a great break for us because people started talking then within the kind of rock community, and the thing that with the Stones was just unheard of.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
Paul was dealing with that very quietly, because he had somebody on the inside that had just taken on a job, you know, working for the Stones, and was going in and out of meetings, and they were one day discussing who they're going to take on tour for the 14 on Fire.
Yeah.
You know, what bands are out there just now, and this friend of Paul's says, you know what, I know a band, you should listen to these guys, bold as brass.
Yeah.
You know, and just really lucky, right time, right place, and just so bold in order to say, you should take these guys, this is a good fit for you. And and they went with it. Jagger liked the group, contacted us, and said, I'd like to offer you 4 shows on a European tour.
It's interesting when you're up for the Stones, because I worked for the Stones for like 4 years, and people think, yeah, man, you're up for the Stones. You guys just hang out and party. It's like, you don't even see them.
Yeah.
And then, matter of fact, when you do the band photo, they go, okay, stand over here. The band's going to walk by. You're going to get a quick photo with them, and then they're going on stage.
I tell you, we did 4 with them, and we also got one in America a bit later as well, because we had built up a nice rapport with them. Luke was cool, and he you know, the 4th show of in Europe, he bought them all a vinyl record that he thought each of them would like, you know, a jazz one for Charlie, and, you know, an old blues record for Keith, and, you know, sort of a harmonica thing for Mick. And when they got this gift from us, we had seen them around, but 10 minutes later it was like, right, the guys want to meet you. And so we were sitting down with Mick Jagger, and we got 2 minutes of his time. He was talking about vinyl, he was talking about when it was out, how funny it is that it's all come round full circle. And then we had a little chuckle, and then the PA came in and took us all away, and then we were standing with the rest of them, with Keith and Ronnie. And they were just talking shit and talking about football and talking about shoes. Charlie Watts, you know, I like your shoes. And Keith was just like really lovely, and you know, he just included you, you know, and just, you know, just keep the band going, guys. You know, that's all you have to do. You know, that's all just a laugh. Just don't take it too seriously. And they were lovely. And
that's
great.
And
we were just hanging with them, and we got some photos with them.
Yeah, yeah. That's awesome, man.
Yeah, yeah.
You guys are out with Deep Purple and Priest, and we were talking last night how weird that is, being an opener for that. Because, of course, they're just there for Priest, you know? And you got to try to just pick off fans. Mm. If you can get 10, 20 in, yeah, out there that are going, then you're going. But how long are you on this tour for?
It works out something like 6 weeks we've been here. And we do 2-3 shows a week with them. And we come on and we do a little half hour. But, you know, we've had a great time with these. The guys have taken good care of us. I think when, you know, going out there, everybody just wants Priest to come on, like you say. I think we just took it like a challenge.
Yeah.
And we're going to get these guys to like us. They will like our band.
Yeah.
You know, they just need to lighten up a bit. And it's, you know, because nobody wants to sort of jump, you know, support the...
Yeah.
If nobody else is, you can see them looking around, you know.
Well, it's that old school too. Like, Priest fans come from that old 80s world of like, fuck the opener.
Yeah.
You know, I'm here. Boo the opener and take pisses and buy beer. You know what I mean? That's the. And, you know, but there are these Priest fans that have kids now and stuff, and they come and, you know, maybe they're in their, you know, teens or early 20s, and then they start going, like, hey, I like that. Because a frontman like you can grab people right away, you know, like, oh, I like the energy on this guy, you know? It's like Rival Sons opening for Sabbath, you know? You've got the first 3 minutes, get these fucking people, you know? Yeah. And if you don't get them then, it's going to be you slowly stay in the pocket, lay in there, confidence, and we're going to get you on something.
That's it, man. You know, and just one by one, if you see somebody, you just hone in on them, because that's, you get that energy back and it just excites you, you know. And I just, it's just your humor. You got to have fun, and you got to just let them know this is okay. We're just having fun here. We're a bit like the Black Crowes, you know. We can be that if you want, you know.
Yeah.
It's okay, you know.
Yeah. Well, especially in their mind, if they can put it in their mind category, you know, somehow, like, yeah, these guys are kind of Black Crowes-y. All right, man. Yeah. You know what I mean? Yeah. It's really funny.
Yeah.
Now, when you guys are out with Priest, and you guys in a van, how are you guys doing this? Because there's got to be no money coming your way.
No, we've been blessed because half of the time that we've been here, just the way that the schedule worked out, it was kind of quite a complicated thing to work out for our TM. But basically, for half of it, we've been with Purple and flying with them.
Really?
Yeah, on their, you know, chartered.
Wow.
Plane.
That's so amazing.
You know, and so we'll fly with them a lot of the time. I'd say about half of it. In New York, when we landed in New York, we had a few gigs around about New York State to do. It didn't work out that we could be with them, so we got a vehicle and we drove to those. And then this week, until the end, we have a vehicle and we're not flying with them because we came here to do this.
Yeah. Deep Purple's got a plane?
Yeah, well, that's what happens when you're a big rock and roll band, you know?
Yeah, but Deep Purple, you don't think of them as having like a plane, you know what I mean?
We've just invited onto it.
Yeah.
You know, and you guys can fly with us, you know, as often as is possible. And,
wow.
You know, and that's been lovely, you know. I know that because everybody always takes the same seat, and so the band always sit beside the same guys, and there's been a huge amount of fun had.
Is it a private jet or a big, like...
Well, it's not like it doesn't say Led Zeppelin on the
side. Of course, I got that, but is it like one of those kinds?
It's kind of small, chartered, private.
Wow.
Private plane. And,
so like a 100-seater or something.
Yeah, and you just go in to this little airport, and you know.
Yeah.
Just go in, and it's been so smooth. Completely unrealistic. Really,
oh my God, yeah.
For where we are.
Your career gets fucked by that, because like your first couple, your third gig is at Royal Albert Hall.
Yeah.
You do some Stones
it's
openers.
It's so backwards. Man.
Yeah, it's so backwards. And then you're on a charter with Deep Purple. Yeah, and then you're like,
and then we're stuck in the mud at the side of the road, changing a wheel on our van.
Yeah.
You know, that's it's just, it's extremes. It's extremes.
It's like when I tour comedy, sometimes I'm in arenas with like a Bill Burr or a Russell Peters or Mark Maron or somebody. They do like arenas and big giant theaters. And then sometimes I'm at a bar where a guy's trying to throw darts or watch a football game. You know, it's like the juxtapose of them is just so wild. But I think what it does do, which is cool, is it keeps you driven. Like I can get... You know, some people will just be comfortable and be like, I'm cool just playing for their people. Where for me, I'm like, I want to get my people and be like this level.
Mm-hmm.
And it gets you focused, you know?
Yeah. No, it's been lovely to see what's out there, you know? We're just really grateful for it.
Are you guys going to do some more States touring after... after this Deep Purple Priest? Because I think really the only way you can do it, like, you know, it would be a great tour, would be you guys and the Rival Sons.
I mean, I've thought about that a lot. You know, we've often talked about that. It would be a good thing. I think that in terms of us coming back over here, it's going to get, we're going to sort that out for next year. I think we need to come out here with a new record and set it up like that. We were supposed to, last year, we were supposed to do some shows with the Rival Sons, and I was really, really looking forward to it. We were supposed to play all over California with them.
Wow.
You know, but it just didn't work out with time, with money.
Yeah.
And it was a shame, because I think it's a good bill. And
I think it's a fantastic bill, you know.
But, you know, these kind of things, that might work out. That might work out one day, you know. But as it is, just as it stands just now, this just back to America by way of a tour with Judas Priest and Deep Purple, we've had a little taste of it again.
Yeah.
But it's actually the end of our... campaign for that record, and when we go back, we're going to start writing a new one.
Oh wow!
And get that out next year as early as we can.
You're in Glasgow now? You live in there now?
Yeah, I live just outside Glasgow.
What was it like growing up there? Like the music scene and stuff. You know, was it? I'd been to Glasgow once with the Stones. It's funny. I always think of Glasgow as it's where I met Tony Iommi. He happened to be backstage at a Stones show. I was like, oh my God, that's Tony Iommi. But I walked around the city for a couple of days, and it was an interesting city. It didn't seem to feel that rock and roll-y to me.
Well, it's a big tourist city now. It's changed a lot over the years. When I was growing up in Glasgow, there was a lot of changes, and it was modern. It had become a modern city from having been an industrial place, and they, you know. What happened in the 80s and 90s was, before I was really involved in music, there was a great burst of bands that came out of, big bands like Simple Minds and there was lots of, bands getting signed, big, things like Deacon Blue and, this Orange Juice, and there was, there was quite kind of cool niche stuff like Jesus and the Mary Chain and all sorts of stuff going on. There's always been a real artistic, creative core in Glasgow, more so than any other city in Scotland. And there was a spate in the 80s where there was a huge amount of signings. Everybody was getting a record deal. And by the time that, I started getting into trying to be in a band, it would have been the early 90s.
Yeah.
And there was still very much a rock and roll heart. You know, it was just what you did. If you were in a band, that was just what you did. You know, you just played it nice and sleazy, and you rehearsed over in Mary Hill in a studio. You drank every single day.
Yeah.
You know,
some Bon Scott shit.
It was just what you did, and I loved it. And I think the thing that happened to me was that when I was about 20, I moved.
Yeah,
I moved away from Glasgow, gave up on it, and went down to London because I thought that's where the big music business was. Unbeknownst to me, that within about 10 years, it was all going to change, and it didn't matter if you were in London or Glasgow or anywhere, you know. When I came back to Glasgow, it was about 15 years after I left, and the place had changed drastically, you know.
Yeah.
But I think it definitely gave me you know, a fire, and you know, to, you know, for singing, for music.
You guys did a Blackberry Smoke tour. When was that? Last year?
Yeah, it was 15.
15. Yeah. Yeah. Wow, 15. God, the years just fucking...
And the stays.
Yeah, just zoom by, you know, the years. That, when you guys were out on that, how long were you out on that?
We were out for about 4 months.
4 months, wow.
With a little break in the middle.
Yeah.
We went home for a week and then came back. It was a long old tour. We saw all of America. We went all over the place.
Yeah.
We saw all sorts of different weather as well. It started off freezing cold. We were in Denver. Snow. 2 feet of snow, and we ended up in, I think, San Francisco or Seattle. We went all down the east, right around the south, saw New Orleans, saw all of that, Texas, saw all of that, and then up the west coast, and we ended up in somewhere like Seattle. In between, we had gone home and come back.
Wow.
And It just blew my mind. It just blew my mind too.
Yeah, how big the US is.
We weren't in a plane then, I'll tell you. We drove the whole thing.
You drove the whole thing? Yeah. In a van?
In a van.
Wow. Yeah. That'll let you know who your band guys are.
Well, it was just the test. It was like, that was the crush, you know. Because, I mean, at worst, you'd be doing a gig, you know, you would have to get your shit off the stage quick as you could, get it into the van, no hanging around, because you had to drive 7 hours somewhere. So you would do three of it, get into a hotel at 2 a.m. 3 in the morning, sleep for maybe 3 hours, get back up and get back on the road, because you need to get there to do the radio show before you do the sound check.
Yeah.
And then you get to the gig, do the gig, and then you maybe do that for a couple of days, you know, until you can get a day free where you just lie in a hotel bed.
Yeah.
You know.
That's crazy,
so
right?
So it was always 7 hours, 8 hours, you know, in the van.
God, brutal.
Yeah.
Are you seeing any kind of, I don't know what the sales are like, but are you seeing any sales? Is it mostly Europe, or what's happening with the record sales?
Well, it's most noticeable in Europe. I mean, the record charted at number 6 in its first week of release. It's done pretty well. I wouldn't like to even estimate how many units have sold, but it's done well for us. It's the most successful record that we've made, Deeper Cut.
That's great. Are you guys, what kind of rooms are you doing in Europe? Are you guys doing sold out clubs or small theaters on your own?
1,500 to 2,000.
Whoa, really?
Yeah.
So you can make some good money in Europe.
Yeah. Yeah, we're doing okay there. We've worked it hard. We've worked it hard for years and years.
Yeah.
And you know, you just got to work hard at Germany. France, oddly enough, Paris is a good place for us to play. We've done all round rural France. All over Germany, all over Sweden.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's great, man. I mean, because sometimes I'll see some of the footage of you guys playing on YouTube, and the crowds are just going crazy, you know? Yeah.
They love it. They love it there. And I think a European crowd outside the UK is a little bit more diverse age-wise as well. One of our best things that we ever did was the Rock Werchter in Belgium.
Yeah.
Massive big festival, you know? And it's one of the best things shows that we ever did on YouTube, and it's one of the most watched things that we ever did. And it was us at the end of an intense touring period, including the Stones and gigs all around that. And then I had a kid in the midst of my wife, I should say, my wife had a kid.
Yeah.
And I was back and forward to deal with that whilst doing Stone shows and this big gig. And we were just fucked. I was fucked and really tired, but we just gave this pretty intense performance at Rock Werchter.
Yeah, yeah.
And the crowd there is pretty, I would say, you know, that's what it's like, you know, over there.
You got a kid, man. Is your first one?
I have two.
Two.
I have a 12-year-old boy.
Wow.
From my first marriage, and I have a 4-year-old girl.
Oh my God. Yeah. It's a that is definitely crazy when you're playing rock and roll and you got kids.
It is because you've got the, you know, and my age and everything. It's a weird mixture of emotion inside, you know, because you have the 16-year-old kid that wants to just, you know, make his own t-shirts and get a band together and you know, have a drum kit in his bedroom and just get, you know, and just keep going and keep going and keep going and make music and make music because that's what matters. And with kids, you know, as much as I love touring with the band in America, I think, well, I've been here 3, maybe 4 times to America. And I've seen some amazing places and been, you know, met some great people. I'd love my daughter to see this. I'd love my wife to be here. I'd love my wife to be with me when I go to, you know, New Orleans.
Yeah.
You know, I'd love for them to experience what I'm experiencing because it seems unfair.
Yeah.
I have all of this.
You're on this vacation.
I'm on this big extended holiday. And I go home and try and sort of relate it to those guys. Or my eyes are open to other possibilities of, you know, what's happening in the world, what we could do, where we could go. But it's, you know, I think that's what we really aim for, is to try and get the thing happening so that all
so you can bring them.
So you can have a crossover. So you can sort of, you know, join those two extremes.
I noticed last night when you were on stage, you were talking about walking around L.A., you went by the Rainbow and stuff. What does L.A. mean to you? To me, it's I got deep, deep roots here. I love the music that came out of Los Angeles. I love a lot about it. When you were walking around, you could still feel some of that energy around there, you know?
I think so. I mean, I can tell that the place has changed an awful lot, and it's...
Totally.
You know, and it's... It kind of sits on a rock and roll heritage that has maybe passed.
Yep.
And you know, you got all the movie stars, and you got everything there that's from now. But you know, I could still feel something of it.
Yeah.
Of what I was looking for, but I think it's all dreams in my head.
Yeah.
You know, it's just all. It's not real. I mean. The Roxy is just a venue. It's just, you know, the Rainbow is just a hang. You know, it's just a good hang. You know, I was never really part of LA. It's a dream to me.
Yeah, yeah. Especially being a kid from Glasgow. I mean, you know,
you just think that everybody comes here. There's rock stars walking about. There's record deals being handed out.
Yeah,
you know, and there's big people in, you know, some limousines handing it.
Yeah,
you know,
get the visions
movies
of those old rock videos.
Yeah.
You know, like, come on in here, son. Yeah. And, you know, Harley Davidson's rolling down Sunset and some guy in leather pants. That's Jim Morrison.
Man, that shit must have been great. You know?
Yeah.
If it ever happened at all. But my knowledge of LA really is the gig that we did last night, because it's a feeling, there was an atmosphere at the venue last night. There was a freedom. I felt a great freedom to play rock and roll music.
Yeah.
In that venue in LA last night.
I wanted to interview the crowd last night badly. Like, for 1 minute, it was the first time I'd been at a gig in a long time where the band is still pretty much unknown. And there was a good amount of people in there. It wasn't sold out, but there was. But they were all different people.
Yeah.
It was bizarre, the crowd I was looking at. I was like, who are these people? And I wanted to interview them to say, like, how did you find out about this band?
Right.
Because to me, I think that is the really important these days, of finding out how somebody found out about this band. Because you're not getting, I don't listen to the radio, so I don't know where they're hearing about you. I've heard about you on YouTube, but I thought it would be interesting to talk to people last night. Like, how did you hear about this band? Because that's such a key to getting a band somewhere is grassroots and word of mouth.
Yeah.
As much as the big promo machine of, say, a Greta Van Fleet has or something, I'm talking about the real organic shit of that crowd last night was in there for a musical experience. Mm. You know, there was not a lot of people on their phones. There was no talk in between the songs and shit. People were engaged. It felt like a late 80s gig to me.
I think it's because it ties in with that whole time, you know. With a rock and roll show, I just always think it should grab your attention. You don't need to be on your phone. You want to just have a great time and you know, sort of watch a band really performing. I'm aware of Greta Van Fleet, you know, and what's happening with them. I love them. Yeah. I just think that it's the most refreshing thing that I've seen, to see young guys, the age I was when I was starting out music, 17, 18 years old, with, you know, the perfect rock heritage, the perfect record collection from their father.
Right.
You know, and you know, so it sounds a little too Led Zeppelin, but I don't care. It's an example of younger people who are, you know, loving rock and roll music, and I think it really does rock. It really does sort of get it going, and it actually sort of being aware of that while I was sort of playing, because you know in LA you see Greta Van Fleet suddenly up there on a massive billboard, and you know, I think that's part of it, knowing that kind of thing is beginning to start again. It helped me certainly just put an energy into the show last night, because it's, you know, we're unknown, we've been doing it and banging on, and I think after a while you feel this is an old thing that we're doing, this is an old thing that ain't sort of appealing to younger people now, and then you can just kind of like get really sort of down on that and not really be focused and alive, you know.
Yeah.
And I think I think last night I just thought, fuck that, you know.
Yeah.
Because as we say, it didn't happen. The band didn't happen in my life until I was an old fart.
I love that part about it. I love that part because you never gave up. You know, I think that's the greatest thing about you, and I can really relate with you, because I just felt like if you put so much time into something in your life, you start to get towards an older age and it's like, why abandon it? You know what I mean? And you're only going to abandon it because of money. But everything else, you know what I'm saying, you shouldn't abandon it for. You know, so if you can figure out a way to survive and just keep going, at the end, you're successful because you did art instead of tapping out, you know? I mean, there was no guarantee when you started that you were going to be a rich rock star or anything. You just did it because you loved it. And if you start to love it again at the back part of your life, you're like, oh, this is... I feel like that when I'm traveling around doing comedy. I'm like... And like when I came to interview this morning, I was looking at all these people in commute traffic and everything, I was just like, oh, yeah, I'm fucking happy. You know what I mean? And at the end of the day, you do need wake-up calls like that. And that gig last night, I was like, if I was in a band and I was just playing to this amount of people each night, but they were way into it, I'm fine with that.
Absolutely. We jumped in the Uber and we'd get back home last night after late on. And, you know, you're on tour, there's shit going on, you're dealing with it, you get sick of each other some days, and then you love each other another day. You've got the wife at the end of the phone. You've got all sorts of things happening. You know, there's shit to deal with. And then you do a gig like that. Yeah. And everybody just goes, that was amazing. That was amazing. Everything just feels okay. Everything feels right.
Yeah.
You know, creativity, energy, performance, that it opens you up and it frees you, but the feeling doesn't last forever. You know, it's not like you can, it's like a drug you can take.
It's a brutal drug
for 8 hours, yeah, and then I'll take another one. You know,
it's a shitty drug though, because you can't go buy it on the street.
Yeah, you gotta work hard.
You gotta work hard for this high.
Yeah.
It's so weird, yeah. and it takes so much to get high. A sound check, like, and like, a long drive.
Absolutely.
Of no family.
All of that shit going, all that stuff. You've clouded mind. Some people have taken acid and you hear about those guys, I take an acid trip and I just sorts me out, you know, and it compartmentalizes everything. And it you get that from the great gig. After a week of traveling around and, you know, feeling shitty sometimes, feeling great, you know, and then you get this amazing gig, and that is what happens in your head. Everything just goes like grid.
Yeah.
I can see perfectly. I can see clearly now.
Totally. The rain is gone, man.
And you ain't taking any acid, and, you know.
No.
You know, it's just you've done your job and you've worked hard. And I think I went out there last night. You asked me about Ellie. I'm so happy and so thankful to just be here,
yeah,
in this town that I have seen all my life on a TV screen, you know, and to sort of be here, and the people and these chilled out people, and, you know, walking around and having a look at this place. I came out last night. I said, I just want to say thank you. I just want to perform and say thank you for having us here,
yeah,
you know, and sort of for showing up. And getting into our band and loving our band and going crazy about our band and telling your friends to come and see our band. And yeah, there was, what, 60 people, 70 people, I don't know. It was,
yeah.
And to play in that venue with all that Sinatra and Johnny Cash heritage, I could, all that great energy just lifted everybody last night.
Yeah. So great, man. Yeah, you know, I think a great tour also for you guys would be the Marcus King Band.
Oh, we've met Marcus. Yeah, oh. We met him.
The two of you guys together would be a fucking mind explosion. I just saw him 2 weeks ago. They played two nights here, and it was. I've seen some incredible music this week. I saw you guys, and I saw them last week.
He's great, isn't he? He's incredible. He's an amazing player. Great singer.
Great singer and great band, you know? Like, the band is really locked in.
Yeah.
The two. You guys, Rival Sons, them, maybe a Nikki Lane, get some kind of country rock flavor in there. Yeah. Some kind of, you know, Joshua Tree tour style thing of just this organic music festival thing.
I'm in.
I know, right?
I'm in.
How great would that be?
Let's do it. Yeah.
And it doesn't need to be, you know, 50,000 people. I'm talking about if we did it and it was just 1,000 people. Yeah. People, you know, the energy of 1,000 people all there for great music is beyond.
Yeah. I'm absolutely in. Let's do it. Yeah.
I can't thank you enough for doing the show. And I really, really pride myself on turning people on to some new music all the time. I get texts and emails daily. Hey, who should I listen to? I mean, there's been so much great music in the last 5 years in my phone that I have to keep it in my phone to remember it all. Mm. People that say there's no good music anymore have definitely died inside. There's some great shit out there, man.
Yeah.
And I hope that you guys come back and do some kind of great tour with maybe another band and more people find out about you.
Oh, man, thanks for loving our band, and thanks for interviewing me today and getting in, for coming to the show last night.
Oh, God. Yeah, I paid.
Thank you.
I paid.
Thanks for that, man.
I was like, I was fired up about a month ago. Yeah. I saw that you guys were playing. I immediately bought two tickets. And I was in New York yesterday. I flew in and I'm rolling on no sleep like you. I'd just been on tour like for a week with zero sleep and I flew straight here to see you guys. I was like, I'm not missing this.
Yeah.
You know, so people that have excuses of like, well, I got to get up early tomorrow and then I got a job and a fuck all that.
Yeah.
Go see bands, man. Go see bands. They're going to change your life. Somebody said something great to me. They said, the minute you stop going out and seeing live music or art or paintings or comedy, you pretty much have died inside. You know, you're not taking in.
If you disconnect yourself from it, then you start thinking that all of that good stuff doesn't exist and it's not really happening because you're just not going out and engaging with it.
Yeah. So, you have Instagram and Twitter, right?
Yeah, the Temperance Movement. On Instagram, TTM tweets.
I gotta ask you the name, because the name for a long time I couldn't even remember the name. I'd have to fire it up. It's like Parquet Courts. I love them too, right?
Yeah.
I'd be like, these two bands. I gotta get. And I have them in my phone. This is them.
It's a hell of a name.
What is the name?
As we end up saying it three times to everybody.
Absolutely.
The Temperance Movement, and it was. I came in with a name before we even. Really, we were a band. We were just, you know, I was on emailing and chatting about getting a band together. What do you guys think of the name The Temperance Movement? I thought it was funny. I don't drink, you know. I've drank a lot.
Yeah.
And I've had lots of times where I've realized that I really shouldn't drink. So
yeah.
I thought it was. I think I didn't really know what the band was going to be. I thought it. You know, if I get this band going, maybe it's going to be like a real raucous, you know, maybe these guys are going to be all bad influences on me and it's going to be fun. You know, we're going to go out, but we're called the Temperance Movement and it's going to be funny. It's really, I set it up like that, but it means something personal to me. It also sounds like the Creedence Clearwater Revival. That's one of the reasons why I liked it, because it sounded like the Creedence. But, you know, it kind of came back and bit me on the ass because from that first tour that I did with the Tem, I'm in pain, I've got sore shoulders, I started smoking weed, and after a few years I was starting drinking again.
Yeah.
And then it became harder. And so I had to really, you know, sort myself out and get back. And then I'm in this band called the Temperance Movement. So for me, it's just a reminder.
A mind
constantly.
State.
I think for the rest of the guys, not being a particularly heavy rock and roll type of band that all goes out and gets fucked up, we've kind of all done it because of the age that we are.
Yeah.
We've done that before we knew each other.
They've been there.
But I think the Temperance Movement is more, it's a kind of serious working effort where everybody soberly takes care of business. I think that's really what it is.
That's great, man. That's great. It's so funny because sometimes I have to look up the spelling. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like I'm trying to punch it into iTunes. Yeah. I'm like, I'm dumb. Sometimes I can't even say the name to people. I'm like, it's the temperance
movement.
Yeah, that's what I say.
I always end up accenting it for the Americans. You know, the temperance movement.
Yeah,
you
know, it's like
what?
It. Yeah, the what? Yeah, yeah. TM.
TTM.
The TM band. Well, thank you, man. And I hope to see you again back in the States, and I hope to be interviewing you again when you have a new record out and we're at a venue and things are fucking, you know, blasting for you, man, because I love these three records. They're all three different. They all three have some deep, deep tracks that I love, and I can't thank you enough for being out there.
Thank you, man. Thanks for having us here. Cheers.
All right, guys. Thanks for tuning in to another episode of Let There Be Talk. Go out and listen to their music. Get it on iTunes. And go see them live all over the world. That's how we keep these bands alive, by seeing them live. Get out of the house and see some live rock and roll. Love all you guys. Keep the candles lit.